Oh, Love Is All We Have Left is the name of the song. It's the opening song on the album Songs of Experience from U2, studio album number 14. Have I left anything out? No? No, I haven't. Okay. Bono Edge, tell me about that song, first of all. Vocoder, is that the first time?
We've done vocal tunes for a long time. This is an idea. Our idea was kind of like a classic song, like sort of sci-fi version of Sinatra. That was the thought.
A classic song version of Sinatra.
Yeah, sci-fi Sinatra.
Sci-fi Sinatra. Okay.
That was the thoughts of it, and it's the opening gambit, so it has to. Yeah. Hold on a second. We're gonna have to just close down this. I'm sorry about that.
What are we?
There's people walking around outside. Yes. Oh, making noise.
Making noise. Okay. So Edge. In fact, maybe I'll ask you, Edge. How's it going? How's life?
It's very exciting. It's that moment where the work that you've slaved over for a long time is finally out in the public. And it's a nice feeling. I must say, this is a record we're very proud of. And I think these songs are going to get better as time goes on. And I'm really looking forward to playing them live.
That word, grow our business. Yeah, playing them live, by the way. I mean, like... Mm. You know the way it happens with you too, like every time a new album comes out and every time you play something live, and it's going to be in arenas this time around, so it's going to be indoors. Mm. Anything to do with the production? Do we know anything yet? Because a lot will be always expected.
We're working under the assumption that this is a sister album to Songs of Innocence, so the show production will be a sister production to Songs of Innocence.
You'll go back down Cedarwood Road the other way.
We'll see. Maybe we'll go down the Hoth Road. I'm not sure.
Yeah, go down the Hoth Road. Yeah.
I took our kids last Christmas, or maybe it was Christmas before, down Cedarwood Road, and they hadn't been there for years. And it's a beautiful little quiet neighbourhood, and they were saying, "This is great. This is where you grew up." I says, "Yeah, it's really, really good. It must have felt different in your head then." Then I said, "Well, everything does, you know, when you're growing up." And then somebody rolled down the window of their car as they went by. A very loud expletive came out, and I'm home.
Right. Absolutely, indeed, and nothing to stop this being the best day ever. Was it important to have that song at the very beginning? Was that? Did you want to make that statement rather than, like, for instance, it's bookended by love, if you like, love songs that I could call, because it's more or less the first song and last song, or that kind of thing. Even though you write a lot about love down through the years, you probably write less about loving. Could I say that?
That's right. We've got a very limited use of the word love in the English language, don't we? We just use it for everything.
Yep.
In other languages, they have different names for friendship or erotic love or, you know, unconditional love. This sort of moves between the three, really. And Love Is All We Have Left is sung from the point of view of a person who's thinking, well, that is all that they have left, and that might be enough.
Okay, well, let's get to the second song there, which is Lights of Home, Haim being on this one as well. Just tell me about that song.
Well, it started out as an experiment, borrowing a riff that was on the Haim record that we loved. It was just a bass break.
Right.
And we started playing around with it in the studio, and got very excited. And it's really a case of the music telling you what to do. You know, you get a kind of a feel for something, and then it starts to just present all these possibilities, new chords, new ideas. So we built that one up, really. That's why we credited them on the record as co-authors, and we asked them to come and do some backing vocals.
Okay, but you've also said, like, that in terms of the lyrics, the brush with mortality that's been mentioned, rather than go into a detail of anything from years ago or from last year, there was a few brushes in the last few years, and I'm just wondering how many of these might come in on top of you. I mean, one of them is the plane going over Germany and the blinking luggage falls out and, you know, the whole bottom of the plane literally goes. And, like, you were on that plane. It might have been, like, did you know what was happening, by the way? Did you, like, you heard a bang, I presume?
Yeah. I heard a bang.
Did you say, right, this is it?
Heard a few bangs over the years. They found my bags, I think, in a field in the middle of rural Germany. And so might have killed a few cows. But I was fine. That's That's not really anything that would bother me.
Okay, but I'll tell you what should bother you. And I'll talk about, like, just on the same level, another brush with mortality, which is, you know, you're cycling your bike, you're talking metal plates, intensive therapy, x-rays, CAT scans, five-hour surgery, facial fracture, orbit of eye, three separate fractures, left shoulder blade, sorry. I'm just, this is the doctor's report, right?
Yes,
fracture of the upper arm. Wait a minute, I'm not different. Six different places fractured, torn through the skin, three metal plates, 18 screws, left pinky fracture.
It was never great at the guitar playing, to be fair.
That's what I would call a brush with mortality.
Edge has been calling my recent times brush with humility, and which is probably more dangerous and more remarkable. I doesn't seem like I can take a hint. But yeah, I've had a few of these, and finally, around about this time last year, I had to just stop and take stock of my physical self, and so I took care of business, and Edge and Adam and Larry went into the studio without their lead singer and just sort of rediscovered the material, which I think was good for you, and I came out of the whole process thinking, you know, this album better be good.
Okay, I thought Edge's tweet was brilliant. We're a man down. It didn't seem to matter, though. They went in the studio and did what they did. Okay, so let's hear the song. This is called Lights of Home. Lights of Home is what it's called. We're looking at the album itself, Songs of Experience from U2. Let's go straight into the next one. You're the Best Thing About Me. This is an album that, in terms of its lyrics, are letters written to. And there are two people that are close to you, maybe the fans, maybe the family, maybe the kids, all that kind of thing. This one is obviously to the better half in your life.
Yeah, I was trying to write a love song that wouldn't be kind of annoyingly sentimental. And I would never do Mrs. Houston the disservice of that. And also to use some comedy where possible, you know. And so this was an attempt to sort of tell her the way I felt and to talk about a moment which really happened and when I had this awful, like, dream, like a kid has, the night terrors, whatever you want to call it, where I thought I'd, you know, lost my love of my life. And I woke up in a strange house, and I thought, oh, my God. They're all gone. My kids have left me. My wife has left me. And then I realized, actually, no, I've left them. And I'm here on my own. And I came downstairs and I went into the kitchen and I told Ali this. And she was just, yeah, just making breakfast and just kind of laughing, like, you know, here's, I'm still here. You're still here. You know, eat your cornflakes kind of thing.
Right. That's brilliant. Okay, let's hear it.
Yeah.
This is You're the Best Thing About Me, and this is from the Songs of Experience album.
But can I say on that song, the key to it is a classic melody. It's like a sort of punk Supremes, and Edge set up that melody. It's one of his best ever melodies, I think. And it's like a dance tune, but we play it like a punk band. So the bass is driving it. And it's got that live, we put an extra chord on, so it's like the Beatles in Hamburg. And the point was, with the sort of all the shit that's going down in the wider world, that it was kind of interesting for us to write a pop song and to just write about what's going on in your personal world and try to write a pop song like the Ramones would or something like that.
But what happens with you, Edge, with this? I mean, does he bring it, like, I mean, like, this is like a question from 40 years ago, but does he bring the lyrics in and you go, okay, let's do some of this, and I've got this riff, I've got that riff, I can do this?
It's pretty much always the other way around. I would come with some music, and then Bono would start trying to find a lyric approach that fit the music. And in this case, this was a tune I started out on the road, just trying to come up with a U2 song that I would want to hear on a dance floor. Not a remix, but a tune. If I was out there and it came on, I'd be happy to stay. Because most of the time, I get embarrassed. I have to literally run off the dance floor if they start playing New Year's Day or Sunday Bloody Sunday. It, because people used to talk about U2's anti-dance stance. And really what they were meaning is that we had loads of energy, loads of momentum, force, vitality, but we're not really about the dance floor as a band. And the one or two times that we have really gone seriously in that direction, which was on Acton Baby,
yeah.
I really went after some rhythmic music, and Mysterious Ways came out of that those experiments. And then early on, working with Danny Lanois for the first time, I still haven't found what I'm looking for. Actually, it's got this amazing groove. So on this album, I just wanted something that had that infectious rhythmic quality from the get-go, not imposed by a remix artist, but actually in its DNA. So I was listening to a lot of Motown, and I was realizing that that music has got this unbelievable joy and this upfulness. And I was going, we should have that on our album, because our band, you know, we can do the sort of painful ballad thing. It's we go to very emotional places naturally, but the joyful thing that we sometimes can get to is the real gold. So it was kind of a set yourself a task,
yeah.
And that's where we got to musically. And then obviously with B coming in, melodies get improved, and now we got a great lyric, and it's. I think it's a little classic.
Okay, well, let's hear the little classic then this time. You're the best thing about me. When you look
so good. 9 o'clock, 51552 is the text, and we're doing it now till 11 o'clock on through the album with, as I say, the singer and the guitarist from U2, and then a bit more tomorrow between 9 and 10 as well. So it's kind of 3 hours worth all the way. So let's get right back into it and see where we were up in his house. Here goes.
And just on the note of, like, the way something is put together, a perfect example sometimes to me is the song that I like best on the No Line on the Horizon album, which is called Breathe. And it's got, like, a lot of different bits and pieces in it. And it's like this and this, and yet it all fits together like a mosaic perfectly and all the rest of it. But you know the way, like, you can have so many bits, like most U2 songs aren't necessarily, you know verse, verse, chorus, verse. There's a lot of other things going on. Would you ever think of doing a full song cycle, like, say, you know, the B-side of Abbey Road, just bits and pieces, just let the whole thing go as a 20-minute piece and see what happens, no matter what the lyrics might or might not be for a second, just the music of just, like, from Polythene, Paramount, yeah, exactly, like your hand is going now.
Singular movement of music.
Yeah, I'm not even saying a concept album now, I'm saying let's call it a song cycle.
We have not gone down that road, but it is an intriguing idea, and I think our band would be a good, you know, unit for that type of an enterprise. We started writing our songs by being in the room together and just improvising, but with a view to the music really taking odd twists and turns. So Adam and myself, for instance, got in the room, and over a course of an hour, we wrote On Cath Dubh and Into the Heart.
Yeah.
Those kind of changes and modulations and chords, and that was me trying to make sense of where Adam's going with the bass and him trying to make sense of where I'm going with the guitar. And although it's improvised, at that moment in our career, I think we were very tuned into what would work in front of a live audience. So these were not like random, just improvs. I think we could do that. I think it'd be a very interesting place to go.
I think it'd be brilliant.
The future is mapped out right there.
Exactly, a 20-minute track.
Dave Fanning.
Because nobody does that anymore, right?
No.
I'm not saying Tubular Bells, it has to be 45 minutes, you know,
yeah.
Both sides.
Yeah, I think beware of the progressive rock lurgy.
No, but hold on. Progressive rock got a bad trip. There's nothing wrong with progressive rock when it's
done. The best of it is amazing. Think about Pink Floyd.
Like what?
Dark Side of the Moon is...
That's not progressive.
Okay, Van de Graaff Generator.
Okay, I'm not going there.
Let's not go there. Okay.
And also Radiohead. I mean, Radiohead have done amazing stuff over the years. I'm a fan.
That's true.
But you have to be very careful with it, because
if you make
sort of music for that's in any way kind of justified by itself without any external subjective.
We formed our band to put down.
I know that. But you've also gone right back to do loads of stuff that you didn't necessarily know. You just mentioned Motown. You went through the roots of all American music with Rattlin' Hum that you were grown up on and didn't even understood it until you went to
that. But the thing about progressive rock was that no clear thought. The reason why the Beatles could never be a progressive rock band is because they had lots of clear thoughts in terms of melodies, ideas, and that's why I quite like that direction. But we have a progressive rock gene, clearly, and you know, on not just No Line on the Horizon, but on Passengers, and we've done a lot of experimental stuff over the years, and some of it we're really proud of. But when you stop, when you forget that where we came from was, you know, big melodies, big ideas, clearly stated, that's all the best U2 stuff. Not everything, but most of what we do, which is explains this album.
Tell us about Get Out of Your Own Way, Bono.
You get out of your own way.
Get out of your own way.
I don't know. I mean, it's all of this. This started off as a letter to my daughter, actually, but it's probably, again, it's just, you know, you preach what you need to hear. It's, you know, if experience has taught us anything, it's probably that the biggest obstacle you're going to meet in the way of, you know, realizing your own potential or whatever is probably, it could be outside forces, but it's mostly not. It's mostly how you're going to meet them. And by the way, that's a sort of that's a whole innocence to experience flip. Because when we were younger on Songs of Innocence, we lived in a world of us and them and, you know, black and white, very clear. And I think in experience, you just start to realize, wow, my demons, they're the things that can take me down. And you will remember this, but on our second album in October, we had a song called Rejoice. And there's a line in it, I can't change the world, but I can change the world in me.
Yeah.
Well, the theme of experience is, well, maybe I can change the world, but I can't change the world in me. It's a flip. And but as it is directed to our daughters or anyone who wants to take it, it was just saying, look, you can do everything that's ahead of you. You have the potential. Go after it. And there's a lot of dark stuff out there, and you're able for it, but you just got to mind your own light.
We should talk about Kendrick.
Yeah.
So
he starts off the song, but then again, we had seen something on Damn before on his album, the Triple X, as I call it.
Yeah,
we ended with Kendrick. In coming out of Get Out of Your Own Way. So Kendrick Lamar, he's quite a character. He's like he's like a young Bob Marley or something. He seems to have real wisdom, you know? And he's got that righteous anger. He's like a fist. But it's also an open hand. He's got a lot of, I think, love in his music, and he sampled this verse. It's not a place, this country is to me a sound of drum and bass. And so then we got him to try these things which we were calling Beatitudes. And so there's sort of mental versions of the Sermon on the Mount kind of thing. And he did it. And I think it's a great addition and a perfect setup for American Soul.
For American Soul, then it goes into, yeah. Okay, let's listen to the song. For the next track, American Soul. The whole idea, this is a letter now. If it's a series of letters, this is a letter to what? To America. Simple as that, is it?
Yeah, I'm amazed I get away with this stuff, but Americans have a kind of vulnerability to Irish people, I think, because they know how much sort of in awe of them. And the idea that is America. And the point was, it's not just a country, it's an idea. Ireland's a great country, but it's not an idea. And, Britain's a great country, but it's not an idea. So what is the thing about America? Why do we all care so much about it? I think it's because there's a lot at stake in its success or failure. And right now it's in a lot of trouble. So I thought we would have some fun playing with the idea that we had discovered America through music, and that America is not a country, it's an idea, and if you close, you have to close your eyes to see it, because it's kind of a mythic idea.
Okay, it's kind of a mythic idea, but like if you look back at some of the stuff that's happened in 2017, from the KKK not wearing the white things, but Charlottesville, that's what it was, being endorsed by the president, and then you go as far as, for instance, as you call it, Edge, the mental illness of racism, raising its ugly head to the point where what? That your whole idea of having a companion album to Songs of Innocence almost went by the board because stuff like this, or the election at the end of 2016, changed everything.
Mm.
Sorry, have I just answered that question?
Thank you. You answered it probably much better than me, Will.
I mean, there's no doubt that we're living in a very difficult time, and so many of the things that we, as a band and as individuals, care about and have fought for seem now suddenly to be under threat. Social justice, you know, the whole kind of progress, as we would call it, in many ways. But I would say that our role as musicians and artists is not to get too mired in the bickering between politicians and this interest group and that interest group, but to put our focus on the way forward and to make sure that in all of this political dialogue that we keep people's awareness of what I believe is the road ahead, proper progress.
Right.
And we've seen a lot of progress, weirdly enough, even whilst it seems very painful. Things like the Black Lives Matter movement. I mean, what really, if you look really closely at that, that is something coming out that's been going on for generations, probably decades, many, many, many years. This bias against people of color by certain factions of the American police force.
Marriage equality.
That's now coming out. The whole thing of, you know, sexual harassment is coming out. These are quantum shifts, Teutonic shifts in terms of the way people view the world around them. This is progress to me. It's painful, but it's progress.
I mean,
so I wouldn't get too worried. I mean, we're seeing Donald Trump now. His ratings are the lowest of any president in recent years, 32%, because it's slowly dawning on people that there's more to life than filling your pocketbook with cash. And that's, I think, why he got in, is people concerned about their finances. But really, at this point, it's starting to become obvious that this guy is not only incompetent, he's actually a bit deranged.
Yeah, no question about it. But then again, where's the person to come up against him in 3 years' time from the Democrats? There doesn't seem to be anybody at the moment. They seem to be letting him run free. Anyway, that's a different point, because I want to mention this song here. Because the song itself, American Soul, you've got to, like, you know, this is a country, as you said before, founded by refugees. And, like, you know, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to break free. It's kind of, that bit's not doing too well. Like, in terms of letting people into the country and whatever, you know, whatever.
I saw one of the, I don't know what the politician was, one Republican politician was had the audacity to say, the statue was there before they put the poem on there. The poem was added later by some liberals.
Yeah, argue that.
You know, so we're in a very strange place where all kinds of, I think what it boils down to, in my view, is fear politics.
Yeah.
It's difficult to sort of keep people with an open heart, an open mind to people of difference if they're simultaneously being told that they should be afraid of them and that they will ruin their lives one way or the other. So when Donald Trump starts talking about rapists being allowed into America, which is, by the way, factually untrue, you know, there are the incidents of crime and rape
is
not higher in the immigrant population.
Yeah.
You're just as likely or more likely to fall foul to a crime from someone who's already in America. And that's
but
true,
I mean,
of terrorism.
As one of you has put it somewhere along the way, that, like, even if some bad people come in with other people, as you say, you can't ban air because it carries a virus.
It's a very easy button to push.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
They've been pushing this button for the last number of years. It's worked, unfortunately, on a lot of the population.
Yeah.
And I think our job as an artist is to get focus away from the negative, from fear, and back onto the things that we can do that are positive.
Okay, well, let's take a listen to the track, American Soul.
Blessed are the bullies.
Well, nearly three, actually, past the hour of 10 o'clock. We're with you till 11. It's kind of 3 hours of you two. Two today and one tomorrow between 9 and 10 as well. And we're looking through the album. That's what it's about. It's music from track to track to track. So let's just jump right back in there and see where we are with the lead singer and the guitarist of U2. Am I going to press the right button? I am. This was done up in Bono's house the other day.
The next one is Summer of Love, the middle track on the album. And this is... Bono, would this be something to do with, or both of you, because you both go down there, you go to the south of France quite a bit to sort of chill out or whatever it happens to be. Mm-hmm. And is it a realisation that just across the water, Syria and madness is happening?
Yeah, it's just one of those things that you just can't put out of your mind once you let it in. And so try to write a really, I think, quite a beautiful love song. Because we, you know, Edge and myself, we share a house down there and our families are growing up down there. We have our friends down there. It's a time when we play music and sort of, you know, fall back in love with all of the things that made us want to be in a band. And so you have that romance, but then, you know, on the edge of it, there's something else going on. And so the song breaks down in the middle into it goes, oh, when all is lost, when all is lost, we find out what remains. The same oceans crossed, for some it's pleasure, for some it's pain. And that's the clue. And then you have Lady Gaga sort of doing her rather wonderful singing. And she told me, actually, when she was recording that, I said, we sound like Patti Smith there. She said, I go on stage every night. I have a Patti Smith album in front of me to remind me why I'm there, which is interesting. I didn't know that. But it's, but the also, I think, I hope what comes across with Summer of Love is that it's so spare. It's so empty. So it's a very different feeling for this band.
Okay, just on the note, you just mentioned something at the very beginning of that there. You said, like, this business of, it has to be that you two are doing something that means something all the time. And the word, the pursuit of relevance, it motivates you to create and all that. Like, there's always an element of trying to kind of reinvent in some ways, or to, you know, remain fashionable in some ways, maybe, or to stave off obsolescence or whatever it happens to be. Do you ever think, like, you don't necessarily, like, there's no such thing anymore as being relevant, I don't think, in rock music. Just make your good music and make your good points in it. You don't have to be, it's not a pecking order like it was around the time of The Clash or something or whatever, who was more real or more street or whatever.
No, the pecking order now is about songs.
Yeah.
Who writes the best songs? There was a great argument, a proper fight between two famous singers in this very house.
Oh, go on, who were they?
And it was Liam Gallagher and Michael Hutchins.
All right.
And it broke down into, I won't say who's said what, but it was, our tunes are better than your tunes. And I was laughing.
I wonder who said that.
I was laughing to myself. And
did he say tunes?
And I said, I just thought it was so kind of silly. And then I thought, actually, there is a sort of empiricism about tunes. The Beatles wrote better tunes than other people. I mean, it's kind of a fact. It's not really, when you get out of the progressive rock world, you're into a place where tunes matter. And that's where our sense of kind of relevancy came, to answer your question.
Right.
We just wanted to write better tunes than other people.
Okay, but like, it's not as though you're ever scared of being out of touch or something, no?
No, better tunes keep you in touch. No one cares about style considerations. Though, you know, using, whatever modern recording is, I mean, to not use it is a big statement. And if it fits your theme, then fine. But I mean, I wouldn't want to be, you know, I wouldn't want a brain surgeon working on me who didn't know, like, what was going in terms of, you know, brain scans or whatever it is. It's just kind of mad, the idea that to be authentic, you just stick with what you started out with. That's just not
That's
true
not
of a painter,
true.
It's not true of a filmmaker.
Right, right.
But there's some sort of box in music, which is, they're trying to be fashionable. Like, we had all that with Acton Baby. It's like, we had all that when we went with Martin Hannett on our first single. People saying, that's not your sound. That's not who you are. So many people have very great ideas about what they think you two should be, but they're not in the band.
Right. Okay.
I would also add that there's nothing wrong with with being part of whatever the creative conversation is at the time. Nothing is ever written in a vacuum. So you're either referencing work from previous eras or you're referencing stuff that's happening now. In our case, what we don't want to do is just be complacent about our sound, our approach, because I think things can get worn out. Things, ideas can get overused to the point where it becomes synonymous with a previous era of work, and we've got lots of work from the past that we love, but we don't necessarily want to sound like we did sound 10, 20 years ago. We're happy to sound more contemporary, and that doesn't mean we have to compromise our approach or do something that we're not naturally going to do, but it's just about being conversant with where the sound of records is at.
Same as we were with when we worked with Eno and when Daniel Lama walked in with a new piece of technology, let's try it out. Yeah. When Edge had the infinite guitar he was playing on With or Without You and all of that. I mean, on Love Is All We Have Left, we have this kind of octaver effect, and people go, whoa, Kanye. It's like, nobody, Kanye. I mean, yes, he uses it to great effect, as do a lot of hip-hop acts. But Laurie Anderson has been left out of the conversation. She started that whole thing. And why is it popular?
Back to Oh Superman.
But yeah, why is it popular? Because in an age of AI, in an age of artificial intelligence, something about the coldness of a manipulated voice can actually capture the feeling. And so I wanted, on Love Is All We Have Left, to have this argument with the younger me and the older me, which is part of the show. And that voice, that disembodied voice, I needed to separate the conversation from the first verse to the second verse.
Okay, well, the song we were talking about originally there for the whole thing is Summer of Love. Let's go for Summer of Love. There it is. Love is the name of the song, and the next one on the album is Red Flag Day, Edge. This punky, funky kind of riffs thing, was that you starting off the whole thing? Was that your kind of thing?
Yeah, that song had an interesting journey because I was working on a tune called The Lies That We Believe, which didn't go anywhere, and then came into the studio on the last record, and Larry was playing this really cool drum beat. So I walked in and I thought, okay, I'll try this other song over this beat. So it started off, became this pretty cool tune with Danger Mouse, but it didn't go on the album, primarily because it turned out it didn't have a kind of vitality. It was kind of a little mid-tempo, a little snoozy. So we had a look at it again on this record, totally changed the beat, totally changed the attitude. Guitar part's the same. Everything else around it's totally different. And what now it's got this incredible vitality, this sort of life force. Mm. And it is like something from 1978. It's really...
But when you say didn't go on the album, if the album had been released when it was supposed to be released, maybe 18
months ago. This is the previous record. This is Songs of Innocence.
Oh, right.
So this was a hangover. Okay. And this often happens with U2. I mean, for instance, the riff that started out American Soul was one of the first things I actually recorded after the 360 tour, way, way back, and it ended up in various different tunes. In fact, there's a reference to that song in Volcano on Songs of Innocence.
On Songs of Innocence, yeah.
But to this one, Red Flag Day, so that guitar part, which is the intro, was the little beginning of that tune, and everything kind of built up.
And when you talk about stuff that didn't get on albums and that, I mean, let's see, 2016, you played a gig, iHeartRadio thing in Vegas. You know, they had all these Donald Trump dollars coming out of the sky and all that. And that weekend, you couldn't go to the At U2 thing in Cleveland. So I went. I was there for 2 days doing all this U2 stuff. But anyway, the point I'm making is that while I was there, the amount of people who were so in the minutiae of U2, and I thought I knew everything. I was going, okay, I don't know. And they asked me about 40 different songs, 38 of which I've never heard of.
Wow.
So I have to ask, are they there? Could they? Like, do you ever discard a whole album, which I think you did once, and is it totally discarded? Or would you, with the next album, go and pick and choose and take bits back to do this? Like, for instance, does stuff just get put aside and might never come out until well after you're dead?
There are things that probably will never see the light of day, and I'm sure for very good reason. But we don't let go of something if we believe there's a potentially great song in there, and we will rework it. We'll leave it to one side for a while sometimes and then come back to it. But it's funny how it's in the DNA of an idea, and it could be something as simple as a great set of chords, great melody idea, great texture,
yeah,
great rhythm section idea, like bass and drums thing. So I would not discount the possibility that all of the little song ideas that these fans came up to you talking about might at some point come out.
Right, indeed. Well, listen, let's go for the punky, funky riff I was talking about, Red Flag Day. Red Flag Day is the name of the song. We are talking songs of experience with you two. The Showman, Bono, this has got to be, you've got to tell me about this one, because you lie for a living.
Lie for a living, love to let on, yeah. But you make it true when you sing along. It's like a country song lyric.
This is now, like, if this is an album of letters to people, this is a letter to the fans, is it, to the audience?
Well, it's just, same. Yeah, I'm just, you know.
A bit of a con sometimes.
You know, on the, when you want to be wary of performers, because performers, actors, you know, we're able to, our gift is we're able to conjure a set of feelings. I'm not best at conjuring a set of feelings if I'm not feeling them. But I think it's, in general, you should just be a little wary of people who are too good at being celebrity or too good at playing a part. And I mean, the irony of this is that you two are our music. I can't really sing it unless I'm inside the songs, unless I'm, yeah. The notes are just too high. I mean, I can't get there. But still, I wanted to write it about myself, being tough on myself. But it's also supposed to be funny. And because that's part of this thing, it's a load of, you know, songs. It's great, you know, Four Irish Lads, songs about death and destruction. That could be great crack. So we wanted to make it fun and full of joy. And U2's always had that side going back for our earliest shows, which you were at, you know, and things can get a little too serious. So the lyric here is, you know, baby cries because it's born to sing. Singers cry about everything. Still in the playground, falling off a swing. But you know that I know. Walk through the room like a birthday cake. When I'm all lit up, I can't make a mistake. But there's a level of shallow that you just can't fake. But you know that I know. And then it goes, oh, you don't care, but you know I'm there. And it's the Showman. And then it goes, the verse, the best line of the album, which is, I wish it was mine, but it's Jimmy Iovine's, a friend of ours, said it. It goes, it is what it is, it's not what it seems. This screwed up stuff is the stuff of dreams. I've got just enough low self-esteem to get me where I want to go. And of course, the thing about performers is, as Gavin Friday says to me all the time, insecurity is your best security. And you don't become a great performer if you're a well person. If you are a whole person, it's the part of you that wants, that gets pissed off if somebody in Croke Park takes a piss during one of your songs. That's insane. And, you know, Edge does not worry about things like that. Larry does not worry about things. Adam does not look, I'm not saying they're not insane, just different ways. But a performer, I'm like, where? But that's what gives you a sense of what's going on, yeah, in a room.
Okay.
And by the way, it can drive you mad, because when you're in a room, could be any room, could be a dinner, you hear what's going on down the other end of the table. Like, people will leave here, this house, and I can say to Ali, did you go out there really in trouble? She said, what? I said, those two, they're not getting on. So I did, what are you talking about? I said, but did you not feel that? She said, I was talking for 2 hours. And I will feel that shit. That's not necessarily good for my own mental health, but it makes you a good performer.
But insecurity is a good security, then, maybe.
So that's what the song is about, bluster and, yeah, and swagger, but the performer has to have that.
Yeah,
wellness.
I mean, the bluster and swagger, can I just say, like, of the year 2017 with the Joshua Tree tour, which was a huge thing in front of 80 or 90,000 people, and maybe over 100,000, 4 nights in a row in Brazil. I was looking up at what was happening in Brazil at the time. You seemed to take over the whole city. It seemed to be, everything seemed to be with TV and everything else. Like, and you're on stage 4 nights in a row in front of all these people, with all these people in your hand who spent a lot of money of their wages to see and come to this thing. The responsibility of that, if you don't have that idea of everything going on in your head about this, It's a mess. The whole thing is a riot. It's
you
rude.
Better be good.
This guy can get away with it by just, you know, doing his own guitar. That's easy. And you man the drums, you man the bass. Well, but you hold these people in the palm of your hand, and it's entirely up to you. Four nights in a row, over 100,000 people.
I think mentally, by far the most difficult job is Edges, because it's so technically difficult. But in terms of the kind of feeling a place, feeling a people. When we played Mexico after the earthquake, you could feel that in the crowd. It's just there. And so I don't know, I can, there's not a lot written about the psychology of singers. There's more about actors. Mm. But it gets a little odd out there, especially if you get inside a song and you can't get out of it. So performing something like Exit during the Joshua Tree tour, I have this character called the Shadow Man. I have to take a bath after that, but I can't have time. I'm just backstage. But he's quite a character. But we won't name the city, but on this tour, I came off stage and Edge is there and I was railing about something. And he has his ear in here, and I think, so he doesn't have to listen to me. And I'm saying, Edge,
it's called a fringe benefit.
I'm saying, Edge, let's go, let's get out of here. He's going, but like, we've five more songs to go. No, that's not right. We've got to go, because I'm still in that character. He's like, can you get a glass of water? As it takes the ears out, you know, you okay, dude? Okay, we can go back out there and do it again. But so I do get a bit spooked. And I mean, I'm fine like 2 hours later, but you can see why performers tend to, you know,
unless you care, that's basically, yeah, you
exactly,
care a lot.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, and also, by the way, just this song, which is called The Showman, it does it come together when sometimes something clicks? When Larry comes in on the drums in a song like this,
he made the song.
Yeah,
well, he made the song.
This is a great example, as we were describing earlier on, of this process of going back into the rehearsal room and starting again, almost as if we were rehearsing for a live show. And in that process, Adam, Larry, and myself really rediscovered the essence of the songs. Because it's something Steve Lillywhite always used to say. When he'd come on the road, like in 6 months after the album was in the shops, and he'd hear all these songs, I'd be going, oh my God, now is when we should make the album. Everything's figured out. You're playing brilliantly. The dynamics are happening. So we wanted to try and get a march on that sort of process. So going back into the rehearsal room really helped with The Showman, because the original arrangement was really acoustic guitar driven. There wasn't really a sense of the band, and we were missing that, you know, because, I mean, cool, we have no problem with acoustic guitar songs, but for the album, it just felt like it needed another few tunes that really showcased what we're like playing live. So
what's that beat that he plays in the end?
Well,
it's like a rumba or something.
It's, you know, this is the era, unfortunately, where rock and roll rhythms have got very conservative. But if you go back to the early 60s and the 50s, and where the influence of swing and jazz was in rock and roll, it really was rock and roll. I mean, mm-hmm. It had swing. It had. So this is a drum beat, which I believe is sort of taken from the 60s, where all of that was happening. And I don't know what it is
it
technically.
It felt very Ringo. And he sat down, I'm not sure he was liking the tune, in all honesty. And he was just, I'll play it. And it really transformed it, because though it's got a sort of attitude, it could come off lightweight. And I think the drums and the bass underpinned it in a beautiful way. It's been mentioned by a lot of people as their favorite tune.
Okay, let's give it a blast. This is The Showman.
Okay, yeah, there's something I was going to say. Oh, I know what it is. Yeah, there's some of these songs from the U2's album, Songs of Experience, have been recorded in a different way. And it's a brilliant thing that's going to be on TV. I think I've just got the RT guide here for Christmas, and I think it probably came too late to be actually included in that. But it's if I'm right, it's going to be Tuesday week, which is St. Stephen's Day. Which would be Boxing Day if you're in England, and it's on around 11 o'clockish at night on RT, one of the RT ones or RT two, I'm not too sure which. And it's basically U2 doing some of these songs in Abbey Road Studios. as Bono says at one stage later on, we don't think it's in the interview, well, the Beatles recorded All You Need Is Love. But anyway, like, they've got an orchestra, they've got choirs and everything else singing the song. It's really good. Anyway, it's next Tuesday week and it's on St. Stephen's Day. You can check it up yourself when the time gets near. Next Tuesday week is Stephen's Day, isn't it? It is, yeah, because Monday will be Christmas Day. Okay, let's go in and do the last bit today and then more tomorrow, 9 to 10 from the album, and just jump right in. And we're in Bono's Gaff.
Any time I've ever heard a U2 album, it's usually up here in this house and it's long before it comes out or whatever. And you cannot put on a song without performing it as well. And it's kind of a, would you get out of the way there, Bono? I'm trying to listen to this. But the point I'm trying to make about it is this. Is that when you do that, one of the songs from this album, about 6 months ago or something, I can't remember which one it was, you talked about how you might do it live or something. And you were talking about, was it quoting from the book of Ecclesiastes or some kind of thing that in that bit here I'm going to, have I just given away something you're going to do in the next
game? No, it was the blackout.
Oh, it was the blackout. Oh, we haven't got to it yet. All right, I wasn't sure which track it was. Okay, well, yeah, we get to that. Because the next thing I want to do is the little things that give you away. Because this is, we're going in the way, the sequence of the album. And this is number nine, track number nine. Now, tell me about this. I mean, this was like, you know, late night anxiety attack stuff, was it?
Well, this is, this, you know, a lot of the songs, not all the songs are letters, but this is a letter that I didn't realise I was writing to myself, in the sense that with innocence and experience, we have this thing with the younger self and the older self, and what would the younger self make of where you are now, kind of thing. And so I saw you on the stairs, you didn't notice I was there. That's because you were busy talking at me and not to me. You were high above the storm, a hurricane being born, but this freedom, it might cost you your liberty. And so it's the young kid going, I can see you, you don't fool me, you're not looking after yourself. And the bluster breaks down finally in the older self at the end. That's how I saw it. And the character singing the end is just is fear. And you know, I don't really do fear. I mean, I'm genuine, just as a person, I'm not that fearful, and I'm certainly not fearful of dying or things like that. I've got a deep faith and all of that. But I will admit that I had those kinds of moments and thinking, oh, yeah, this could be inconvenient. There's a few albums to do, and I'd like to see my family grow up. I'd like to, you know, I'd like to be around for Ali and my friends and stuff. So that that litany at the end is the character who's the showman and who's full of bluster finally unseated.
Okay, but this album was meant to be, or was talked about in terms of letters kind of to people, and like, as though you're dead, as Brendan Kennelly put it. Did you do that in the end of the day, or did you take that even any step at all? Because if you think this might be your last kind of utterance, it might prioritise what you want to say. And this is the year that, like, when Leonard Cohen died, when Prince died, when David Bowie died, and maybe it made you think. Or does it go back to Songs of Innocence in terms of Iris? Because you've always said that when your mother died at the age of 14, and the whole idea of just what it did, that, I don't know, like, it just, it completely focused you on what you wanted to do in life, or how you were going to about whatever it is you were going to do.
Yeah, it's I mean, I think in psychology they divide it into two halves, don't you? There's the fear of being alone. You know, the fear of, so you the first half of your life's about friendship, making relationships, and then the fear of not being here. And I kind of waltzed through the second part of that until recently. I must say it was tricky seeing, you know, for all of us who loved David Bowie and loved, you know, Prince and Leonard Cohen, he was such a prince of a whole different order of gentlemen, a lesson in humility. And I just, it was just a thought, you know, just to say, well, forget the melodrama of the moment that I'm going through. Just for U2, this is a good discipline, because who knows when the next U2 album's going to be. Yeah. So let's make sure it counts, and let's make sure that we're on the record with the ones that we love.
Okay, well then let's hear the song. This is The Little Things That Give You Away. Give You Away is what it's called. That is U2, Songs of Experience. We'll go on to the next one, which is Landlady. Now, Landlady, I mean, this is something that you're, like, again, Edge, what happens with you with a song? Like, well, what's he got this time? Or do you have music saying Bono? Is this the way it always works?
That one was started on acoustic guitar with myself, Bono and Ryan.
That's about the fourth one that started. Did they all start on acoustic guitar?
Well, we did a lot of that. A lot of, because we were trying to be very disciplined about the songs.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jackknife Lee takes a lot of credit for the final kind of sonics of that tune. He did a great job with pushing it away from the traditional into this quite unusual place. And I just, melodically speaking, it's like a peak for Bono, and lyrically.
Well, lyrically, I love it. Call it losing if the prize is not for you. Is that Ali again, is it?
Well, you know, it's just, again, how to write a non-obnoxious love song. And because I always write sort of dark and twisted ones. Because, again, this is an immense person in our life. And, writing some sort of, saccharine ode is just not going to work. And I found Landlady an amusing image because Ali paid my way when we were kids. And in my head is just, I shouldn't say this, but there's sort of Bob Dylan in my head. I'm doing an impersonation of Bob Dylan when it goes, and I'll never know what starving poets meant. Because when I was broke, it was you that always paid the rent. And I just hear it as, I'll never know what starving poets meant. And I can hear his voice. But it's a true song about someone who paid your way, but also is the reason to come home. And, you know, I've been a stray dog since I was 14.
Yeah, of course.
And Edge knows this more than anyone. I'm not naturally a person who would, I'm not a home bird until very recently. And now when I'm away, I just think about home. I think about Dublin, think about Ireland, think about our friends. And for me, it was always where Ali was or my kids where it was home. But I'm getting more of a keener sense of home. And but if I am, it's through her.
Is there more of a mature thing about songs like You're the Best Thing About Me and Landlady as a kind of a progression from, say, something like The Sweetest Thing? Or am I, wait a minute, there's no connection?
Well, no, because even The Sweetest Thing is I'm losing you. So
yeah.
You always look for duality in songs. And by the way, these autobiographies, they're never completely true. There's a leg of somebody else's relationship or an arm of another's. And, so you write a line like, you're the best thing about me, you're the best thing that ever happened to boy. And then as a writer, and he goes, well, the next line better be funny. Okay, so you know the best thing about me, I'm the kind of trouble you enjoy.
Yeah.
Okay, that helps. But the third line better have a twist in it. You're the best thing about me, the best things are easy to destroy. Okay, you're the best thing about me, why am I walking away? And then whether it's walking away on tour, whatever it was, it felt real in that moment, in that incident where I thought, what would happen if you lose everything?
Yeah.
That's...
Okay, well, that's You're the Best Thing. This is Landlady.